Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 5.2, The Peace of Paris. By the spring of 1782, the United States found itself in a somewhat strange position. On the one hand, following the Franco-American victory at Yorktown, the British had agreed to halt the war effort in North America. On the other hand, though, the war wasn't actually over, as fighting continued between the Americans and the British Allied Indians, while at the same time, the French suffered a devastating loss at the hands of the British Navy. Oh, yeah, and also the United States was completely and utterly bankrupt. So, despite winning a key battle, therefore, nothing was certain heading through the spring and into the summer of 1782. Now, everything that we are talking about here is taking us towards the eventual collapse of the Confederation government and the Constitutional Convention. However, before we can get everybody in a place where they are ready to blow the whole thing up and start over again, we must first look at exactly why the Articles of Confederation ultimately proved to be such a spectacular failure. The way I plan to approach this is by taking it one topic at a time. This week, we are going to focus on bringing the American Revolution to a conclusion. Then, next time, I'm going to return to the economic question and look at how the financial crisis undermined the entire system. We will have an episode on the disbanding of the army, as well as the numerous questions that came up during the middle part of the 1780s that the Articles of Confederation were unable to deal with. The thing to keep in mind here is that these episodes are all going to be overlapping with each other. Rather than a straightforward, dedicated narrative, these are all going to be events that are happening contemporaneously to each other. So over the next several episodes, please do keep in mind that everything that we are talking about is going on at the same time. I will have an episode at the end of this series that will tie everything nicely together and move us into the Constitutional Convention. The idea of peace was a concept that was fraught with danger. Very quickly, the American delegation had caught on to the fact that everybody involved was acting in their own best interest, and that even amongst the Allies, significant disagreements existed. Congress took a much more optimistic view of the state of the negotiations, more or less telling the American commissioners to sit there and let the French do the work for them. The American peace commissioners were made up of four men. Among this group was John Adams, who was in the Netherlands finalizing a loan and the recognition of the United States, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, Henry Lawrence, and Thomas Jefferson. Now, if you are sitting there thinking, hey, Alan, that's actually five, give me just a second. Now, John Jay had been in Europe for a while, mostly banging his head against a wall in Spain, a country that was sort of like an ally, but had, as of yet, agreed to acknowledge American independence. Henry Lawrence had likewise spent the last few years in Europe. However, if you think Jay's stay had been rough, Lawrence had been far worse, as he had been a prisoner in the Tower of London. Finally, we get to Thomas Jefferson, who was busy back in Virginia, and thus, by the time he joined his fellow commissioners, the work was already done. So we're not going to count Jefferson, and that leaves us with four men. Now, thankfully for the United States, the peace commissioners understood the absolute insanity of trusting their entire future to French machinations. Sure, yes, the French had been really helpful during the war. But now that peace negotiations were opening up, it was going to be imperative that the United States look out for its own interests, which may well differ from those of the French. The last thing that any of the members of the commission wanted to do was establish the United States just to have it become a French vassal. The British negotiations were going to be driven primarily by two men, Charles James Fox and Lord Shelburne. The problem that quickly emerged for the British is that Fox and Shelburne were very nearly polar opposites. Shelburne, the secretary of the Southern Department, which included the soon-to-be former colonies, absolutely loathed the idea of independence for the United States. he still, probably delusively at this point, hoped that maybe the Americans would agree to remain loyal to George III in exchange for a separate American parliament. Fox, on the other hand, had stood as an advocate for American independence. He was a skilled orator and a leader amongst the opposition. For our story, American independence is the key question that we need to be focused on. But to be sure, the divides went deeper than that. These two men hated each other's guts and very quickly would emerge as bitter rivals. For Shelburne, his involvement in the process depended upon the colonies remaining just that, colonies. By the nature of their positions, Fox was in charge of foreign policy. Shelburne, as the secretary for the Southern Department, was in charge of the North American colonies. Should the British recognize the independence of the United States, Shelburne would lose his justification for being a part of the negotiations. Shelburne did have a plan of action for the negotiations. Chiefly, he wanted to break up the harmony between the Allies. At the end of the day, the French would always pose more of a risk to the British than some pesky backwater colonies located an ocean away. The last thing that they wanted, however, was for the French to gain a new ally in that part of the world, which could potentially threaten British interests. If the British could separate the Americans from their French allies and treat them both independently, the British may still be able to stymie French ambition. Thankfully for the British, the American peace commissioners were proving open to defying their orders and conducting negotiations without French assistance. In late March 1782, Shelburne received a letter from none other than Benjamin Franklin that he might be willing to have a discussion. Although there were several peace commissioners, Franklin was largely on his own at the beginning of the process. As discussed a moment ago, Jefferson would never join the commission. Adams was up in Holland, Jay in Spain, and Lawrence was a British prisoner. From the beginning, there had been frustration with the French for the slow pace of negotiations, with the Americans believing, not incorrectly, that the French were intentionally stalling for time. In order to open negotiations, Shelburne turned to Richard Oswald to act as a negotiator. Oswald was a safe pick for the British. A Scottish merchant by trade, Oswald was, by the time of the negotiations, an old man who had little political ambition. In this way, he posed no meaningful threat to the power of Shelburne. Oswald had made his considerable fortune through the slave trade, and before the war had actually worked in that capacity with Henry Lawrence. Wanting to give a show of good faith and likely an endorsement of Oswald himself, Shelburne went ahead and had Lawrence freed on bail. Oswald, while acknowledging that the United States was honor-bound to treat with the French, as per Franklin's insistence, explained to Franklin that a peace between the United States and Great Britain may well prove much easier to obtain as compared to a peace with Britain's ancient rival, the French. Oswald further explained that at the end of the day, of course, everything needed to be jointly agreed upon. However, in the interest of efficiency, surely they can begin the process of hammering out some of those points ahead of time. Now, probably unsurprisingly, the most important point that the Americans were demanding was an acknowledgement of independence. Although the biggest issue, the recognition of independence was not the only thing that the United States was seeking. There were questions of boundaries that would need to be settled. Fishing rights were of a particular concern to New England, not to mention answering the revolving question around commercial treaties. The one ask of Franklin's, though, that might have been the most surprising, was that he wanted the British to cede Canada to the United States. Canada, of course, had long been a sticking point for the Americans. They had always envisioned Canada as being the 14th state. The real fear here, however, was from having the French retaking their Canadian holdings. Sure, the United States was grateful to the French for their help in the war, but nobody had forgotten that entire first half of the century, that there had been numerous wars between the French and the British, that had made Canada a hotbed of fighting. Nobody wanted to see the French regain a possession that they themselves had spilled so much blood in capturing back during the French and Indian War. The French were aware of this uneasiness in the Americans towards the prospect of a revival of French Canada. Vergennes had considered this possibility. However, the French really did not have any interest in regaining Canada. French interests were now focused on holding the Caribbean. To help assuage the fear of the United States, therefore, Vergennes had assured the Congress that he was not interested in recapturing Canada, and specifically had this included in the Treaty of Alliance. Going further, he had cautioned D'Estaing that treading carefully in Canada was in everybody's best interest. This, however, is not to say that Vergennes was wanting Canada to go to the United States either. What Vergennes wanted was for Canada to remain in British control. The idea was that should the British retain Canada, it would act as a check on American expansion and would pose a continual threat to the United States. This threat would help ensure that the United States would have to remain cozy with the French to protect them from the possibility of a future British incursion from the north. Although it seemed like a somewhat far-fetched idea, we know that both Adams and Lawrence seemed to believe that the acquisition of Canada was at least a possibility. Making things more complicated was the fact that Oswald indicated to Franklin that the idea of the United States assuming control over Canada was not totally out of the question. Here, however, lies the problem of having middlemen during negotiations. Although Franklin must have been pleased to hear that the idea was not outright shot down, he was not exactly sure who was okay with Canada coming into American control. Was this something that Shelburne was cool with? Or rather, was this something that Oswald thought sounded good? He told Franklin that he felt pretty confident that the Canada question would satisfy the Americans at the end of the day. It was an ambiguous comment because Franklin could never really be sure if he was dealing with Shelburne's own thoughts or if he was dealing with the mere personal opinion of Oswald. Canada aside, the real goal for the British during the negotiations was, again, keeping the Americans and the French separated. Should the British be able to separate the Allies, they could potentially get a far more favorable peace in North America, while at the same time ideally driving a wedge in the still young Franco-American alliance. To this end, Shelburne made at least some overtures towards a separate peace with the United States, to be formed away from Paris and instead in the American Congress. Everybody was sick to death of war, and maybe the Americans would be willing to come to the table and forsake the peace commission in Paris, if it meant a quick conclusion. What would have been truly ideal for the British is if an individual state would agree to peace, thus threatening the American Union. For this task, Shelburne had Guy Carleton reach out to George Washington to see if he might be interested in an armistice. The initial proposal was to halt land warfare along the Atlantic coast. It said nothing about the fighting that continued along the frontier with those British allied Indian tribes, or about a continuation of naval warfare either. Washington did not even bother to send an officer off to Congress with the new offer. Carleton would make a second attempt a bit further down the road, this time offering up an acknowledgement of independence. The hope here is that the Americans would be so blinded by gaining their independence that they would promptly neglect all other issues related to the settlement. In other words, you were fighting for independence. Here is the thing that you were asking for. Now please, get out of the way and allow the adults to finish talking. Neither Washington, Congress, the states, nor the public were falling for British attempts. If the plan had been to separate the French and the Americans, this particular attempt had fallen completely flat. Now, before we return to Paris, I want to remain with Washington for just a moment. For the Continental Commander, 1782 proved to be a tense time for him. Although we know today that Yorktown marked the end of the major campaigns, Washington did not yet know this. He worried constantly that fighting would begin again at any time. This really was not that far-fetched of a possibility either. Washington was well aware of significant fighting along the frontiers. He likewise was aware that the British and the French were still duking it out down in the Caribbean. Was it really that far out of the question that following de Grasse's loss in the Battle of the Saints, that a reinvigorated British army would make a last attempt at getting something out of their North American theater? These worries were mostly for nothing. By the middle of the year, Washington and Rochambeau had decided that, with negotiations taking place in France, the best course of action was to stand pat. Washington had floated the idea of an attack on Canada. However, as we know from earlier today, Rochambeau had little interest in wading into that hornet's nest, and politely poured cold water all over the idea. The French were, more or less, done with the ground war in North America. By the second half of 1792, it was increasingly obvious to Washington, and everybody for that sake, that the war there was indeed coming to an end. In August, the British announced their intentions to evacuate Charleston. During that period of time, between the announcement of the evacuation and the actual withdrawal of troops, British Commander Alexander Leslie reached out to Nathaniel Greene with the following offer. "If you allow us to peacefully forage, we will stop sending said foraging parties out armed. It would mean less danger for everybody." Worried, though, that this was a ploy to capture as many American slaves as possible, Greene rejected the offer. These foraging parties go to show that even now, as peace looked increasingly likely, significant danger remained. As if giving a tailor-made example here that the British were not intending to just placidly move out of the way should the Americans come knocking, we have John Laurens, who would learn this lesson the hard way. Laurens was always something of a risk-taker. Recall that back during the Siege of Charleston, he had badly exposed his men by far exceeding his orders, getting wounded in the process for his troubles. Unfortunately, the experience taught Laurens nothing, and with the war coming to an end, he remained desperate for what had thus far been that elusive battlefield heroics that he so desperately craved. Getting wind of one of these foraging parties, Laurens set out with the plan that he would score a final win over the hated British enemy. He raced out of camp, picked up some men along the way, and charged headlong towards the British party, with the intention of cutting off their return to Charleston. Rather than surprising the British, though, the British surprised Laurens. They laid an ambush for him to charge right into. Obliging, Laurens did indeed go recklessly charging into the British ambush and, rather pointlessly, got himself killed. Upon learning of his son's death, Henry Laurens would find himself heartbroken and sick with grief. He would barely be able to continue his function as a peace commissioner. Although dangers certainly did remain in North America, the situation was clearly trending towards peace. The British, despite their attempts, failed to convince the Americans to make a clean break with their French allies. However, this is not to say that the American peace commissioners were following congressional directives either, and just falling in line behind the French. The Americans were indeed conducting negotiations with the British outside the presence of their French overseers. These negotiations were not exactly clandestine either. Vergennes was aware that the Americans and the British were conducting their own negotiations. He was likewise aware, heading through the summer and into the fall, that the British plan had shifted. They still wanted to separate the Allies, and now their hope was that if they gave the Americans what they were asking for, and the French and Spanish tied up the whole thing, the delay would encourage the United States to cut their line and conclude a separate peace. Vergennes, as a counter to this, went ahead and encouraged the United States and Great Britain to conduct their own separate negotiations. This accomplished a few things. First, it made it far easier for him to control the pace of negotiations, to help ensure that everybody was moving at, more or less, an equal pace. Neither the French nor the United States would be stepping on each other's toes. Second, it was a sign of good faith to the United States and proof that the French were not trying to needlessly jam up proceedings. The American commissioners were not going to be forced to sit at the table, desperate to be given their independence, while listening to the French and British negotiate the port rights of some insignificant island off the coast of India. Finally, at the end of the day, it was agreed upon that these negotiations were fine, so long as nobody signed anything official until everybody was ready to sign. In this way, the original alliance remained perfectly intact. There would be no separate peace. At the same time, things would become a bit more cohesive for the British when Rockingham, the Prime Minister, up and died. Shelburne became the Prime Minister and Fox was forced out of the ministry. Over the course of those often slow-moving summer months of 1782, Franklin and Oswald worked towards coming up with a list of conditions. They split those conditions into things that were necessary to bring about the peace, and those that the United States had merely hoped to obtain, but were not necessarily required. Unsurprisingly, the number one thing on that list was for an unambiguous recognition of the independence of the United States, and a removal of all British troops from within the borders of the new nation. Their other necessary conditions included those fishing rights, which were so critical for the New England economy, the establishment of firm borders, and at a minimum, a setting of the Canadian border at its traditional boundary. By this time, the outright annexation of Canada had fallen from the necessary side of the ledger onto the "it would be awesome if it happened" side. Independence, though, was still proving to be a difficult question. The British had come around to the concept that it was probably going to happen. However, there remained a question of when independence would officially come. John Jay, who had reached Paris that June, believed that it should be a prerequisite of the peace talks happening at all. Franklin, seemingly more understanding of what the concession would mean politically for Shelburne, agreed that official recognition would come as an article of the peace agreement. Eventually, Shelburne would give some ground on the subject and agree that the term United States be added in the official instructions to Oswald. This was sufficient enough for John Jay, who considered it tacit recognition of American independence. This question over independence, and the timing of it, was no small thing. It was the very core issue for the United States and was a political headache for the British. Historian Samuel Flagg Bemis writes that the tacit recognition of the United States contained in the language of the instructions given to Oswald would have likely still garnered a denial by the British that it was an overt recognition of American sovereignty. The specific language laid out that Oswald was to deal with representatives of the colonies under the title of the 13 United States. As Bemis points out, the unclear wording put everybody into a spot to make of it what they would. The United States would be able to claim that the British had recognized American independence. Whereas, should negotiations have gone sideways, the British could deny any such recognition. As to the establishment of borders, this proved to be a difficult issue. None of the European powers were all that enthralled about giving the new United States unfettered access to all the lands out to the Mississippi River, which is what the Americans were requesting. Likewise, the Spanish argued that the border of West Florida, something that they had captured from the British, should follow the Ohio River, with the British keeping control over the north bank of that same river. This would have the effect of hemming in expansion from the upstart Americans. Had this gone into effect, the western border of the United States would have roughly followed that hated proclamation line that the king had put in place some 20 years earlier. This question over boundaries became a particularly fraught question, as the main adversaries in this debate were not the United States and Great Britain, but rather between the United States and their, albeit nominal, Spanish allies. The Spanish had, as of yet, failed to even recognize that the United States was a thing that existed. And as this disagreement grew, turned to their other ally, France, for help forcing a settlement. The French were admittedly in a tough spot here. On the one side, Vergennes recognized that American independence was being held up because the Spanish and the British were still out there actively fighting for control of Gibraltar, a battle that the British were clearly getting the upper hand in and would ultimately win. The tide would begin to seemingly shift during the late summer of 1782, when John Jay, seemingly without even Franklin's knowledge, opened up communication with Shelburne through an intermediary. Jay essentially laid out the argument, both towards the issue of borders, fishing rights, and independence, that if the British goal had been to separate the Allies, this was the opportune moment to do it. If the British gave in to American demands of independence, which Jay acquiesced to coming in the form of that recognition of Oswald in his commission, as well as on the borders and the fishing rights, then the Americans were not all that interested in holding out for the Spanish to cave on Gibraltar. Ironically, unbeknownst to Franklin or Jay, by the beginning of September, the British were prepared to cave on the issue of recognizing American independence. The British wanted this thing over, and there was a possibility that had Jay not taken the actions that he did, actions that seemingly got things moving again, the Americans may have ended up coming out with even more. Once again, turning to Samuel Flagg Bemis here, he theorizes that this might have even meant the Americans acquiring Canada all the way up to Quebec. This, of course, failed to come to fruition. However, with the British agreeing to that kind of, sort of, recognition of the United States, negotiations really began accelerating heading into early October. Jay, sweetening the deal, appealed to the British interest in the American West. In his proposed peace, Jay and Franklin offered up joint passage on the Mississippi for both the United States and Great Britain. More than anything, he assured the British, through that joint control over the Mississippi as well as access through Canada, that British manufacturers would have easy access to the American West, which, following the Revolution, would be teeming with land-hungry Americans eager to gobble up European goods. Through the treaty that the Americans were now proposing, the British would have exactly that kind of access, a potential economic boon that would, hopefully, take some of the sting out of giving the United States the western borders that it sought. Jay also took some efforts to encourage the British to pull troops out of their garrisons throughout the United States and use them to push the Spanish out of West Florida. Jay made unambiguously clear that he far preferred shared borders with Britain as opposed to the Spanish, whom, again, were at least nominally an American ally. Turning yet again to Samuel Flagg Bemis, who I clearly have been leaning on heavily today, he points out the fact that at the end of the day it worked out better for the Americans that Jay lost on this point. Spain would end up in control of Florida, where they would mostly remain hemmed in. The British were far more powerful and may well have had far more grandiose territorial ambitions than did the Spanish. Not to give away too many spoilers here, but as we are going to see this season, the United States would very quickly get some pretty grandiose ambitions of their own as they move into the era of Manifest Destiny. I will likewise mention that this will not be the last time this season that we see John Jay showing some clear leanings towards the British when it comes to diplomacy. By October 5th, the Americans had put the finishing touches on a preliminary peace agreement with the British, one that would go into effect upon the signing of a peace agreement between the French and the British. In this way, the Americans could at least save face and pretend that they had not violated their treaty with the French by concluding an independent peace. things were not exactly done here in October. The British had learned of the failure of the Spanish bombardment of Gibraltar, which had seemingly strengthened their position. Additional negotiations took place over the exact location for the northern borders, as well as a discussion over the rights of the loyalists and creditors who had been shut out because of the war. However, by this point, those had become the final issues to hammer out, as the skeleton of a final deal was now in place. In these final negotiations, John Adams would finally reach Paris to take his seat, with Henry Lawrence literally sauntering up to the table on the final day. The preliminary articles of peace would be signed on November 30th, 1782. In the first article, the British agreed to recognize the independence of the United States. It was agreed that the northern border of the United States would exist in the same spot where it remains today. In the south, the border would run along the 31st parallel, which would roughly follow the path of the St. Mary's River. To the west, the United States would indeed call the Mississippi River its border, with the Atlantic acting as the obvious border in the east. Americans were permitted fishing rights off of Newfoundland and the St. Lawrence, a critical concession to the New England fisheries. Creditors on both sides would be protected and debts would once again be subject to collection. On the matter of the Loyalists, the articles which were adopted agreed that Congress would strongly encourage the state legislatures to return property that belonged to British subjects. However, as I am sure you can all imagine, the level of encouragement never really exceeded a strongly worded letter and a request that began with, "Pretty please." Other stipulations of the peace included that the British would withdraw their forces from North America, although this came with the somewhat nebulous wording of, "with all convenient speed." Finally, it was agreed that the Mississippi River would be open freely to both the United States and Great Britain. The French, who were hemorrhaging money and were desperate to end the war, agreed to a preliminary peace on January 20th, 1783, the same day as the Spanish. And just like that, all military activity came to an end. The final peace was signed on September 3rd, 1783 in Paris. As a few final notes regarding the peace, Spain did not capture Gibraltar. Although the British did agree to provide a silver medal and cede Menorca to the Spanish, who had captured the island during the war. Despite the wishes of John Jay, the British also ceded both East and West Florida back to the Spanish, whom, if you will recall, had ceded the territory to the British following the Seven Years' War. With that, it was done. The War of American Independence was truly over. Some 20 years after the very first signs of division that would become the imperial crisis, which would itself become a global war, the United States was officially an independent nation. As to that question of the role of the North American colonies in the greater British Empire, that question had been definitively answered. The world had changed in other ways as well. The British had suffered a stinging loss. The French had drained their treasury and were very nearly bankrupt. This will, in due time, become a major contributing factor in the coming French Revolution, one of the most significant events in all of Western history. Although the war was now officially over, there still remained a lot of unanswered questions. As we proceed through this season, especially up through the War of 1812, we are going to see the failures of the Peace of Paris come to the surface and begin to understand the long-ranging consequences of that treaty. All of this, of course, is in our future, but it is something that I want you to keep in mind as we move through this season. Next time, we are going to turn back towards those economic woes of the United States in the aftermath of the war. The United States was broke and desperately needed to get itself onto some solid footing. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as Robert Morris tries desperately to save the economy.